Well, thank you very much, Asaf. Just one minor thing. I was the co-founder of the Boston branch of Camera. Camera had already existed. That office. You know, I'm imagining our audience here in COVID, and I'm imagining that everyone listening is quite upset, if not actually ill, over the state, if not the fate of America and the West. Well, here's a very brazen claim. I've got something for that. So listen up. Sometime in the early 1990s, I discovered quite by accident the Arabs in North Africa. I saw it in an article in The Economist magazine, which described how black women and children were being bought and sold for about $20 a piece in both Sudan and Mauritania. Well, this stunning piece of news appeared on page 47. I was riveted by this, two things about it. First of all, how could blacks be slaves on our watch in the last decade of the 20th century, it was then? And secondly, why would news of such a horror appear only in a short piece on page 47 of the magazine? Didn't we just end apartheid? Isn't slavery a lot worse than apartheid? Don't we have powerful human rights groups? The Economist was essentially saying, as Joe Biden might put it, here's the deal. Black people, guess what? It's nothing to get too exercised over. Why was that? Why was that? I thought about those two questions for, you know, 15, 20 years. So in July of 1994, I was lucky enough to publish in op-ed in the New York Times about this. And I started, and that helped me start a campaign to free the black slaves of North Africa. The New York Times piece was called Bought and Sold. It was published in 1994, and it did spark international interest. I figured I had to go meet the diaspora elements of both the Mauritanian and Sudanese communities in America. So I went to New York. I organized them both. I started to publish. I published in the Wall Street Journal, the Boston Globe. Most importantly, I got on Black TV, Black television. And I created allies in the American Black community who created a firestorm about this issue, mostly in New York. Our movement got support from across the political spectrum in ways that might be impossible today. For example, we got Barney Frank on the left, and we got Pat Robertson on the right, black slaves. Of course, we didn't try to put them in the same room, but they did sign the same pieces of paper. We got support from almost the entire black community, the NAACP, Eleanor Norton, Congressman Donald Payne from New Jersey, everyone but Louis Farrakhan. So let me pause here. Farrakhan actually was cornered by reports of Arabs and Muslims enslaving blacks, because his mission, as we all know, is to convince and persuade black Americans that Islam is the path to freedom, not to enslavement. So our group, the American Anti-Slavery Group, helped a very heroic Swiss group called Christian Solidarity International, which set up a way to free thousands of slaves in Sudan by buying them back. These slave redemption missions got enormous international press. And finally, we got to President George Bush, who cared very much about this, especially the onslaught against Christian blacks in Sudan and the enslavement and mass murder of blacks in Sudan then. And Bush forced a partition upon Sudan, which was Africa's largest country. And he created the world's newest nation by that partition, South Sudan. Now, let's flash forward today. Blacks today are enslaved in five African countries by Arabs and Muslims. They're captured, bought, sold, raped, bred, given as wedding gifts, and if they become, we would have called it in the South here, uppity, they will be killed. Francis Buck and I are here this afternoon to tell you that this issue, to make a case that this issue, the enslavement of blacks today by Arabs and Muslims, and the intentional ignoring of this practice by progressives and Islamists, may be just the key that we need, the key to what everyone here on the call, I imagine, is earnestly, nervously looking for, which is a way to defend and bolster America and the West. So why do I say that? First, let me take a few minutes to explain the basic data about this ongoing slavery today in Africa. So the Islamic Republic of Sudan began a jihad and that they waged against the black, mostly Christian south of the country. So that is that through the 1980s and 1990s, Arab militia armed by Khartoum stormed African villages. They killed the men and they captured the women and children as slaves. The men were not captured as slaves because this kind of slavery is not like we know in the South. It had nothing to do with musculature, plantation, you know, lifting bales of cotton, et cetera, et cetera. It had to do with ideological, religious defeat of the enemy and concubinage, that is the making of more Islamic people through the rape of the slaves. The boys, as you'll hear from Francis, who were captured, were made goat herders. The girls became domestics until they reached puberty, when, of course, they became concubines and sex slaves. So now the jihad in Sudan is over, and actually we're reading wonderful things about a miraculous turnaround in Khartoum, but there still are about 30,000 slaves left in the north from this jihad slavery, still serving their Arab and Muslim masters. Now, Nigeria. In Nigeria, a similar Muslim on Christian onslaught is occurring now. You may recall that Michelle Obama herself got very upset about Boko Haram's kidnapping and taking of young girls as sex slaves and forced converts. And she started a movement that you may recall. It was hashtag bring back our girls. And she was livid for about a week. And then she dropped it completely. And my guess is that somebody told her that this was Muslim raiding and enslaving Christians. And then she got really quiet about that. In Mauritania, which is a special interesting case and horrible, there are about 500,000 slaves. And I get these numbers from the UN even and from Amnesty International. This is a special case because the Arabs had conquered and forcibly converted Mauritanian blacks to Islam centuries ago. And what that means is that the slaves who are owned by Arab Berbers today are, and please think about this phrase, they are black Muslim slaves. And I think that phrase would feel like chalk on a blackboard to Minister Farrakhan. I know it would, because we actually embarrassed Farrakhan with the issue years ago when he was forced to spend time and energy denying that there was slavery in Sudan by Arabs against blacks. In fact, the New York Times reported an incident at a press conference when he was asked about it by reporters, why aren't you speaking out about the slavery in Sudan? He got very angry and he said, he threw back at the reporters, quote, if you think there's slavery in Sudan, why don't you go there and find out a report on it back to us? Well, two reporters from the Baltimore Sun did exactly that. They met with our friends at Christian Solidarity International, and they bought the freedom of a couple of slaves, and they did a five-part series on the front page of the Baltimore Sun, and they were nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and then Farrakhan shut up from then on in. Today, though, he remains more than ever exposed and vulnerable on this particular issue. Think about it. He is the one person who, with one speech, could do more to free slaves than anyone on the planet, One could imagine a million-man march of blacks led by Farrakhan saying, free the slaves. So we did Sudan, Mauritania, Nigeria. But also today, in Libya and Algeria, blacks who are trying to flee from violence in the center of the continent, let's say in Nigeria, are caught in these countries and are enslaved. And CNN has a video of two black men being auctioned off in Libya for about $400 a piece. All of these things I'm saying, by the way, can be found on our website, iabolish.org. Videos, testimonies, videos of Farrakhan being embarrassed, videos of slaves being redeemed, etc. So I now want to introduce Francis to your audience so that you can hear firsthand actually what it would have been, what it is like to be a slave. And Francis, by the way, wrote a great book, which you should buy, My Flight from Slavery. I think I've got the title wrong. He'll explain it. And after Francis goes around, well, he did before COVID, across the country speaking about this on college campuses, being on television. After Francis's talk, I have want to finish with a short summation, and then we can do Q&A. Francis.
Well, thank you very much, George Jacobs, here for host. This is an opportunity that I always yearn for, and I am humbled to be present on this virtual interview. I, you know, take this opportunity as a way to advocate, not just to tell people about what I have actually went through and endured and where I spent my youth hurt from age 7 to 17 and thereafter struggling until I made it to the United States, the greatest nation. But I am most specifically concerned and hurt when I hear people are still just young men like me and boys and girls are still being slaved today in the 5 prominent African countries. And yet nobody talking about that. Something that make me sometimes when I hear people talking about the movement that just started here in the United States recently, Black Lives Matter. And please don't take me wrong, I'm not against it entirely. But I have a little bit observation and a question that I throw in. If Black Lives Matter, why is it not matter for my people? Because as Dr. Charles just described, that two black men would auction away for 400 a piece. That is just a little thing that you can hear about it, but no hundred of others that are being soul into Middle East and somewhere else, and those who are trying to cross over to Europe through Libya and Algeria and ending up being slaves. That is something that I feel strongly to, you know, such a platform to echo on this and ask more of support and more of people to join us. However, I'm going to tell a little bit, given the short time that I have, I was captured at age of in 1986 in the village of Gorion in southern Sudan then, one of the region of Sudanese, Sudan as a country. Age of 7, imagine witnessing a people being slaughtered and just next to you, people whom you were just chatting with a moment before the market was actually sieged and turned into a bloody field where you see people lying on the ground, which were dead bodies. You see the blood running like water into a river and people shouting for help and seeking for exit, but there was no exits. In that evening of 1986 is a day that I farewell my family, a day that I never saw my family again. I will never see them again, my mother, my father, and two sisters, and many of my friends whom we used to play underneath our mango tree, and all the people that I knew then, including some other relatives, because my family were actually killed along with many other family. And and if you ever watched Dr. Rwanda movie about the genocide that took place in 1994 in country Rwanda, that is exactly what happened in my village and every other village around in southern Sudan then. And my victim were, my family was the victim of that kind of killing. And I also witnessed the same thing in the marketplace where my parents sent me to sell eggs and peanuts, and end up being taken to the north of Sudan as a slave for the next 10 years of my life, serving a gentleman who converted me and who asked me always to call him Abu, a father, and attend his goats and cattle. When I did a good job, I was graduated from taking goats and sheep and then taking care of thousands and thousands of cattle. A job that I never get appreciated for, a job that I'm the first one to work out in the morning and last one to go to bed. That was my life routine, while also enduring other insults and abuse, being called a beat, which means, you know, black or slave, or pretty much Arabic N-word for N-word. That was my daily routine. However, after multiple attempts, I made it successfully to the capital of Sudan, Khartoum, in the refugee camp called Jabarona, where I was helped in a black market leaving Sudan to Egypt by boat. It took me entirely 1 month from Sudan by land to Egypt. And from Egypt, I was able to get my refugee status, coming to the United States as a legal refugee, sponsored by Lubin Social Services, a Christian organization to form in North Dakota. Upon arriving in this beautiful country, I immediately thought about the people I have left behind. People like Bajok, one of the young men who is master, one of the rich guys, the camels in the area where I was actually herding the goats and cattle from my master, who one day sick, very, very sick, and he asked his master not to attend the camels. And instead of his master telling him or taking him for treatment, he was tortured. They, I don't know, imitation, they cut off his left leg and his right arm, just a way to torture him, calling him his lazy, no authority to reject or say no to his master or either to ask for any favor whatsoever. And I was taken to that place, that house, to witness this young man, a sign of me being scared and being made to do my job, or otherwise, how they said. But Joe was not the only one. There are many young men and women that have been tortured. Some even get blind because of disobeying the master or not doing rightfully what they need you to do. So when I first came to this country, I asked myself a question. Now I have all this freedom. What is good is my freedom if my people still live in dream of freedom. You know, because I remember Bible well, when I was there for 10 years, I used to lie with at night and wonder who will come and free me. And as you and I and all, and those who are listening to us, sitting in comfort and freedom, although we are not comfortably like we used to be before the pandemic, but at least we breathe. We have AC, we have everything at our home. I was sitting in freedom and comfort, but I'm in those countries that we described, five African countries, including my own, and around the world, who will lie awake at night and wonder who will come in freedom. And this platform actually addresses that question, because this is why we're here. And I thank the webinar for having us be on the platform to share these stories and to really ask people. I'm very, very a little bit upset about how much people are willing and capitalize on things that are less severe than what my people do, is how America is now being turned into, you know, all the things that are happening. And there are people that I'm afraid that are getting that opportunity, using that opportunity to penetrate the agenda. Because the movement that I see in this country today, I can tell as someone who lived and all the people who live in my people, and who continues to do as we speak today, because of the religion, because of their ideologies, they are using this movement, Black Lives Movement, to penetrate and to actually expand and to get their message across. So something that I feel is dangerous for all of us, as dangerous as far as for my people back home, and dangerous for us even here in this beautiful country. So I just wanted to stop here by saying that I am privileged to be here, and I look forward for a lengthy conversations in future opportunities that you may render to me again. I just want to thank Charles Jacobs, because without him, I would have not had this opportunity today and publish a book, Escape from Slavery, The True Story of My 10 Years in Captivity and My Journey to Freedom in America. So basically, through the American Anti Slavery Group and through CSI, Christian Solidarity International, and through American people from all walks of life, and then administration of President George W. Bush have helped us. Today, South Sudan is an independent country that is less than 1% of people are still suffering in all the other countries that we mentioned. And even our young country that gained independence in 2011 is still struggling, because they're still privatizing and causing tribal war amongst our people, so that we do not have that stability and prosperity. So I just want to thank you for this opportunity, and I'm here to take a few questions.
Let me thank you, Francis, and let me just summarize the main pieces of what we want to say to people. So I believe that a call to free today's slaves can be not only the moral thing to do, but a game changer practically in America and in the West more broadly. And I want to give you five or four reasons why I think that the humanists in the West, that includes all of us, should do exactly that. To call for the freedom of Black slaves in these five countries. So first, it should be done because the slaves in Africa need help from Western humanists to be freed, and we know we can do it, and we have done it. Second, we should do it to break the taboo on exposing or even speaking about evils and human rights abuses perpetrated by people of color, by non-Westerners, and most especially by Arabs and Muslims. To make this call would force the leftists and the utopianists to confront the question they most hate when they discuss what they think is Western sin, and that question is, compared to what? To do it to show how anti-Western ideologues and activists are betraying those who are amongst the world's most abused, because they focus almost exclusively on Western conduct. And we should do it to also explore the psychopathology that drives that mindset of theirs. We should do it to throw a monkey wrench into the inner workings of intersectionality, which has victim groups as non-white victim groups, victims of the male patriarchy, the white patriarchy. Well, what happens if one of those victim groups is found to be enslaving another member of another victim group? We should do it to undermine Farrakhan in his own base, because what is he going to say about his silence or his denial about what's happening to the people he says he champions. So that's, I think, we should also have a discussion about the rhetoric of the Jewish community, which often refuses to go on the offense and is continually finding itself in defense-only positions. So that's those are the messages that I think we wanted to bring and discuss with you today, and thank you for the opportunity.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Charles, and thank you, Francis, for that really very critical topic that needs to be unpacked, and is really not spoken about as much as it should. And obviously, Charles, you spent a great deal of time bringing awareness to this topic. So the floor is now open. And as I said before, if you have a question, please click on the hand icon. I'll be able to unmute you. You could always also type in your question and I'll be able to read your question as well. Alex, why don't you start us off, if that's okay, with your first question, and then while people are thinking about questions, and we'll go from there.
Sure. So let me just echo what Asaf had to say. A vitally important subject, a powerful presentation. What would you both say about the political environment that we are living in right now, and the ability of people of conscience of whatever background, whatever color, to consider and act on this issue? Charles, you pointed out the issue of intersectionality and the ability to and the necessity for people to confront unpleasant and unhappy realities related to slavery in Africa. Can this be done in the current political environment where the American Black community, the American Muslim community have all of their issues and orientations? And
yeah. Well, I think that it was done. And that was 20, 25 years ago. It was much more easily done. And in fact, as I explained, we were across the political spectrum. There were Christians who cared about this because the slaves and the people who were massacred were in Sudan Christians. There were humanists who cared about this because they cared. There were principled people who cared about human rights. The world has split apart ideologically, as you know, and I believe that the human rights establishment is essentially a fraud, and it's a hoax. It's not about human rights abuses. It's about improving or scolding Western conduct, right? I remember once I went to a big Amnesty International meeting where the fellow who was speaking was from Rwanda, and he was talking about the Rwandan genocide, and the audience, and all of these human rights people, the vast majority were white students, decent people, right? They're very embarrassed when they thought that they were hearing a story of Blacks who were committing horror against Blacks, and they were uncomfortable. And once the guy made the point, I think, you know, that he could blame Western imperialism for all of this. Well, then everybody relaxed and they, you know, that's. So the human rights community is basically, at least at the establishment level, is a hoax because it disproportionately points at the evil that the West has done. And it flees from the actual horrors, real horrors like slavery. I mean, slavery is worse than apartheid. I remember when I first started the movement, I thought all I have to do was to be anti-apartheid movement. Well, no, because the whites there were very happy to be pounding their chests in the marches against apartheid under the banner of I'm not a bad white guy, you know, and the rest of you might be. But so this had nothing to do with the actual with the actual perpetration of horrors on people. If you wanted to scale this, you know, what's the worst things that are happening? They didn't choose it about what the worst things. They chose it as an ideological and a psychological way to expiate their own white guilt, which they had imbibed forever, having gone to American schools, which are taught by people who want them to have white guilt. So today, it's different. If you wanted to do this today, and we do, I think we would more be likely to be successful if we approached Black conservatives. I think it's very important here to involve, and we are, the Nigerian American community, which is an incredibly successful diaspora, you know, doctors, brilliant people, and whose people in Nigeria are, you know, experiencing these horrors. So I think the reason to do it, I mean, it's they're tied together. If that were to happen, if Nigerian churches were to have demonstrations and rallies, and if they were joined by Blacks, conservatives mostly, I imagine, I think that would be that would change an awful lot of things that are happening in America. If the Republican Party would call for the freeing of Black slaves, and you know, it's too bad to say it this way, because the Democratic Party won't, you know, and they should, and they used to. And that by itself is a metric of how bad things have become in the last 15 or 20 years, because I did get Barney Frank on my side and I did get Matt Hentoff on my side. And I got a lot of Democrats on, but now they won't do it because they need to focus on the evil of Western white sin. And they will throw under the bus all of the people who are victims of non-Western abuses. And that includes not just the Black slaves, but the women in the Muslim world and the Middle East and the Christians as well. So I that's why I think this is this topic is a can opener. So that's what I have to say.
Great, thank you. And so let me read them and feel free, both Charles and Francis, to tackle them. Some of them obviously, you know, could be a longer lecture, but let's try to get to some of them. The question that our friend Tom Levy has, and maybe Francis, you want to go into this, or Charles as well. You know, what do we know about the slavery in northern Cameroon today? And is there, you know, do we have any information about that? And what can be, you know, how does that relate to some of the work that you guys have been doing as well?
I'm sorry to say I know nothing about the slavery in northern Cameroon.
Okay. Well, that wasn't easy.
Yeah, this is Francis. I had to say also the same thing, so just because we cannot ignore that question. I feel terribly bad not knowing, but this is to tell us that the work is actually overwhelming and everything is going on around, but nobody knows it. So I either do not have any information, but certainly will take this as a homework to get to learn about it. And next time have more information and more in depth of what is happening there.
All right, great. Next question by Marjorie Gann, who is a obviously highly recommend Francis's book, is worth reading. She's asking to the point, Francis, you know, maybe you want to expand a little bit on the kind of reception, obviously pre-COVID, that you would get on specifically American college campuses or anywhere else, given the intersectionality that we find. Obviously, many of us here at SPME and other places, we unpack and tackle, unpack orthodoxies that are not always comfortable. How is your topic received? And I would add, especially, you know, if you have, on the heels of the movement of Black Lives Matter, which does not address at all any of the topics of Black slaves or anything along those lines, what kind of reception do you get on a college campus, and does it cause people to pause and think about exactly the you know, really the integrity of their movement when they're not really tackling any of these issues?
Well, thank you for the wonderful questions. I think that since the pandemic, I have not had opportunity to speak widely as I used to be, and that is with the condition we all are aware of. However, previously, you know, the message was well received. What I have noticed that people shock that this thing still happening today, and how little they knew about it or never heard of it at all. And the second question is anybody doing anything about it? And I always say, don't think of anybody now, begin with you. Begin with you writing letter to your representative, calling the White House, talking to your pastor, your rabbi, talking to anybody, including your family. Get involved yourself, because each of us has what it takes to make a difference. So that's how, and of course there are few here and there, and I remember some incidences like Michigan State or some other places where you have some people that contrite themselves into the audience and try to deny this is not happening, but there are not many, and nobody listens to them, because this has many proofs. I'm a living proof. I lived it, and I had a book for it. There are many other evidence, like the State Department report about it, the White House know about it, and the UN knows about it. So there's nothing that you could say the American Civil Group is doing it because of whatever other causes. So this was the reality, and the CSI was traveling there every other month to Southern Sudan and some other part of the world. So I can say that it would be interesting just for today, because of the new movement, it would be interesting to see what reaction people would have, because my biggest concern is that people are so much concentrating something that have completely little to argue about it. It just been used as a political letter. This is what I could say, and also an opportunity for those who have here ideology to advance them through this cheap platform, Black Lives Matter. And I'm sorry if I sound off. This is just, I'm scared. That's why I say what I say, because I know the people who are behind this have their own agenda. So I'm eager to test out what would be the reactions, you know, if I had an opportunity in the future soon. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Charles, related to your question, Michael Ross has a question about mainstream Jewish organizations who champion human rights and their responses. You know, he references the fact that, you know, 20 years ago, there was a great deal of galvanizing the community as far as free. What do those individuals say today? Have you tried to approach those same individuals today when it comes to talking about this topic?
Yeah, I'm writing a book about this, and the chapter on Darfur is interesting. Just let me say two things about it. Darfur was a distraction from the regular anti-slavery movement in Sudan, because people grabbed onto Darfur to be able to say, oh my God, things are happening, let's do something. And they would never say who was doing anything to whom. It was like, you know, the Hatfields and the McCoys were having an argument, and that's what's going on. And it was very, you know, it was very vague. And I understand that was on purpose. So the Jewish community itself, let's back up a second. My favorite line on the Jewish community and its struggles in our time is by my friend Daniel Pipes. And he says, who would ever have imagined 100 years ago that the Jews would have made the best soldiers and the Arabs the best publicists? So the Jewish community has always, in its majority, responded to attacks on itself and on Israel with simple defenses. We're not as bad as you say. We didn't really do that one. It's complicated. We have something to say as well. But they never did what anybody else would have done. Like, what are you talking about? Occupation? What are you talking about? The Arabs have slaves. Why would you focus on, you know, the Dershowitz has this great definition of anti-Semitism, and it goes back to that story that everybody knows, that a president of Harvard said, you know, didn't want more Jews to attend Harvard, and he was at a board meeting, and he said, you know, the Jews cheat, and Leonard Harris said, well, wait a minute, the Protestants cheat too. To which the president of Harvard said, but you're changing the topic. I'm talking about the Jews. Well, that's exactly what anti-Semitism is. And the Jews don't understand that. A lot of Jews don't understand that because they like to talk about themselves as well, perhaps. But this is exactly what the New York Times does every day. Mr. New York Times, why are you talking about the apartheid wall when there are 24 fences and barriers across the world separating people in conflict? Why did the Jews only have the apartheid wall? Why do you talk about the 8,000 or so Arabs killed in conflict with the Jews when there are millions of Arabs who are killed by other Arabs? How can it be you're talking about the Jews? We're changing the subject. Well, the Jews don't want it. The Jews need to change the subject a little bit here. And say, if you care about human rights and that's why you're out in the streets about Palestinians, how in the world would you ignore or deny the fact that as we sit here today, hundreds of thousands of Black people are enslaved by Arabs and Muslims? This has nothing to do with human rights, your position. It has to do with you're talking about the Jews. So I'm annoyed at my own people for not learning this lesson, and I think that they should. So that's, you know, the Jews today wouldn't touch Darfur. Most of the Jewish organizations, which by the way are more daily being influenced by, if not taken over by, a harder left in the Jewish left that includes the ADL and the Conference of Presidents, if you know about all these ongoing controversies, they wouldn't touch, and they could be called out for it as well, by the way. So I think that what we need to do is to help. It can't be as it was 20 years ago, a movement led by a Jewish white guy like me. It has to be done by Blacks, and it has to be, unfortunately, only done by Black conservatives and Nigerians and Sudanese and other diaspora groups. And if the voice came from them and the call came from them and the demonstrations and the articles came from them, what indeed would the wokists do? What indeed would the leftists do? I think they would be in a corner like we had Mr. Farrakhan.
Thank you. As a segue to that, our friend Steve Gersoff has a question. You know, there's obviously most of you know that there's a great deal of ink spread on these fake claims of Israel apartheid, you know, making the fallacious accusation that Israel is an apartheid state. He's asking why is there no publicity about the slavery of non-Muslims by Muslims, and he's asking whether or not, really, you know, to the heart of the issue, is it because slavery is a religious issue, and Westerners don't want like to criticize somebody else's religion.
Well, that's certainly a big part of it, because, you know, look, as Dennis Prager says, and I like how he says this. He says everybody in the world had slaves: Christians, Muslims, Jews, Blacks, everybody had slaves. So the only issue is who stopped themselves from having slaves, who doesn't have slaves anymore. And the Muslim world didn't do that. So, you know, you can't say that, you know, they're worse because they had slaves, because everybody had slaves. But you could certainly say, where's the emancipation movement and the abolitionist movement in the Muslim world? And I will tell you now, I'm kind of excited by some of the developments in the Muslim world, by people leaving Islamic beliefs and by people becoming secular and by people who wanting democracy. And it would not surprise me, and I'm working on this in some way, it would not surprise me if some of the liberal Muslim voices start to mention the enslavement as one, you know, slavery as one of the reforms that needs most intensely to happen at the moment. The other reason Mr. Gerzhoff mentioned is that who should say? Who do you expect to say to educate the world about the fact of Islamic enslavement of blacks? It's not going to be the New York Times. It's not going to be the Anti-Defamation League. It's not going to be the Amnesty International. So it has to be. It has to come from people on the other side of this deep, deep political division. And that's why I hope to gather, and I am gathering, blacks on the conservative side and putting them together with Africans.
May I just request, I'm very sorry. I had a class that started 9 minutes ago, and I would really appreciate if I can be excused so I can be more late than that. I wrote professor. I'm actually in school, doing this interview in school. I wish that I can be excused for attend this.
No problem. Do you have, before you leave, any final words? And you know, obviously we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us this afternoon. So are there any final, you know, before you have to depart, Francis?
Really, my final word, more of looking in depth into what is happening in 5 prominent African countries today, where Arabs are enslaving my people, and nobody talked about this. Everybody, the last person who asked the questions pretty much asked the right question. And I think Dr. Charles has elaborated many times in his comments here during this interview. And this is the question that I want to ask back to people, because we need to make more awareness about this. We need to say, these real things are happening, are being done by these people, and we must call them by their names. And one thing that I would say is that Mr. Luis Farrakhan has a strong voice, as Dr. Charles mentioned earlier, for one tweet, for one speech, he can free my people. Then it's all rhetoric and denial and cover up. This is what I would say, and he has that obligation. I think it is a last call for him, because he ran out of time. This is the time for him to speak out to free the people. With that, I want to thank you, the host. I want to thank our listeners and those who contributed, asking good questions and interacting with us. I want to thank you, Paul Jacobs, and I look forward for a future opportunity soon, and even more longer time, so that I can tell my story in a full detail.
Great. Thank you for joining us, Francis. And we, of course, you know, cognizant of your time. So we will continue with Charles with a few minutes that we have left, but we appreciate you taking the time and look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you. Dr. Charles, I'll leave you carry on.
Okay. Thank you, Francis.
You're welcome.
So Charles, in the time we have left, we have a few more questions that are coming in. Let me go to Sai's question. He wants to know, can you discuss the extent of organized Muslim Arab slave trade of East Africans that coincided with the European Atlantic slave trade that continued through the 1960s, the intersection that went on there?
I would point to a book by Murray Gordon about the Arab slave trade. Murray Gordon was a UN researcher, and he wrote a really delicious book about what happened in Africa. Look, the Arab slave trade originated long, long before the Western slave trade. It involved many, many more slaves, and it is extended long after the West came to have its, through its abolitionist movement, the stopping of the slave trade. I think that that's, I don't know much more about the actual details of the question that he asked.
Okay, fair enough. Alex, just going back to you, I just wanted to, you know, make sure, you know, you comments, you have to weigh in on some of this here.
I'll make one comment, and that is to express a fear along that this issue not be cast, and this is something you've talked about, obviously, that this issue not be cast as an explicitly Christian concern, an explicitly conservative concern. All of us, you and I, Asaf, and everyone on this call have confronted this issue with relations to Israel and with relation to Middle Eastern issues in general, and being vilified for coming at these things from whatever position we do. And I guess my question, my comment is, how do we even build coalitions or inspire, let's say, Nigerian Christians or conservative African Americans to become involved without being seen as manipulating this for whatever other reasons or with a hidden agenda?
Yeah. Well, that of course is the that's the question. That, how do you bell the cat? Look, first of all, it would be wonderful if classical liberals were thriving, but classical liberals, who would be exactly the people who would want to hear a cry on the basis of humanism, they are being defeated by the progressives. We know that, and they're not defending themselves very well, actually. We are all classical liberals, and we're being defeated by whatever you want to call it, wokeism, postmodernism, political correctness, whatever. So it is true, in the best of all possible worlds, which we no longer exist in, to say let's free the slaves should go to everybody's heart. But because the world is divided the way it is, there is no way, Alex, I believe, to say this without the other side immediately casting you the effort as political and as Islamophobic and as, you know, whatever, as a distraction from the real sins of the white Western world. So I don't think there's a way to do it anymore. I mean, I, you know, 20 years ago there was a way and it worked. So therefore, the only people, I believe, right now who will act on this are the very, 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 very few people left who are classical liberals, undefeated or unbowed. But there are many, many more people who would do it because it combines the two things of their own humanism and their own political necessities and statements and battles. So you could imagine Black Republicans caring about this because it shows to the world exactly what they've been saying is wrong with the other Black movements, the Black Lives Matter, the, you know, intersectionality stuff. There isn't any way, Alex, that I can think of how to do that where the people won't immediately be called out as having a political agenda. But you know what? Doesn't mean you shouldn't do it.
I'm in full agreement. I think the issue is just a question of getting that equation kind of up front, that you're going to take your lumps and on the one hand, but also that it has to be thrown back into the accusers' faces, that they're trying to deflect about the substance of the issue with these other accusations of...
That's exactly right. It's kind of like pinkwashing. When they say about the Jews, well, you're pinkwashing, you got to turn around and say, no, 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 no. you're Jew washing. Why are you focused on this and not that? That's the question. If that is so much worse in terms of human rights, why are you focused on this other thing? So you're absolutely right. It has to be thrown back in their face. And there is no way to get out of it. And I think we should do it. And by the way, my heart, I was in Sudan. I interviewed girls who were gang raped by jihadists and who were enslaved. And when they brought them back, I heard their stories. This tears at the heart of anybody if you've got any heart in you. So it's not only political at all. It's truly a humanist thing. And you would read Francis's book, you'll cry.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that this is, you know, obviously an unknown, you know, a topic that has been hidden, unknown to the majority of, you know, the public. And obviously, when people are marching around under the slogans of Black Lives Matter, this is not even in the consciousness or the conversation as it relates to what is happening around the world as it relates to these matters. And this is the heart of the issue of intersectionality and what we see all over American college campuses, as all of us know, that the real atrocity of the day is, of course, you know, the occupation, the Israeli, you know, the post-colonial narrative. You know, this is, you know, this is where it all ties into the environment that we see today by deflecting from other real atrocities.
Yep.
Obviously, a lot to talk about. And you know, this is obviously, you know, Charles, you know, a very powerful and a very important topic, you know, and obviously something that we need to continue discussing. Unfortunately, you know, our time is gone by, and you know, this is definitely, I think, opened up the eyes and ears, and of course, I'm sure the hearts of the people who attended this afternoon. I want to thank you for that. I want to thank again Francis for taking the time to talk to us. I mean, his story is extremely powerful, that kind of firsthand account. So I want to thank you both again for taking the time to talk to our members this afternoon. There's a lot to discuss, and of course, Alex, as always, for joining me. We will continue this conversation. Obviously, I apologize for not getting to all the questions. Please feel free to send me those questions to bdsmonitor@spma.org, and we will do our best to tackle them in a timely fashion. So with that being said, I hope everybody is doing well, and hope that you will continue to join us for our next call. Next week, we'll be hosting Dexter Van Ziel, who will be talking about what's happening in the, obviously, our issues are not going away, notwithstanding COVID. I would say they're actually, they're growing and expanding. So we hope you were able to join us for that. And so, Charles, again, thank you. Thank you, Alex. And I wish everybody a good afternoon, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.